You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's no secret that there are big divisions in American politics these days, and it can feel like things are getting worse over time. Our next guest says there's been a great pulling apart over the last few decades, and that's a worrisome sign for the future of representative democracy. But she says there's good news. There are concrete steps we can take to make things function better by renovating our political system and our attitudes to reflect new realities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see driving the divisions in American politics? Do you feel like our system of representative government doesn't always represent us that well? What changes would you like to see? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Danielle Allen is a political theorist and the James Brian Conant University Professor at Harvard University and founder and president of Partners in Democracy. She has a regular column in the Washington Post. Danielle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Glad to be with you.
In one of your pieces on the Great Pulling Apart, you share a family story that I think influenced some of your thinking about American politics and really illustrates what it could be about your father and your aunt, each of whom ran for office from a very different perspective. Can you share that story with us?
Sure, that's right. Now, I was fortunate to grow up in Southern California in a big extended family, lots of aunts and uncles and cousins, and we were a family. We are just people who have always loved and fought for democracy. So civic engagement was in the air and water. That said, people were engaged across the whole political spectrum. So there was one year in my youth, an amazing year, when my aunt was on the ballot in the Bay Area, Northern California, for Congress for the Peace and Freedom Party, which is pretty far left on the political spectrum. In the very same year, my dad was running for Senate, for U.S. Senate from Southern California as a Reagan Republican. So we had the most incredible family dinner table conversations. I mean, they would just go at it, really, you know, and he was like this skinny guy, very professorial, always smoking a pipe and smoke curling around his head. And my aunt was a really big woman, sort of built like a Mack truck. She was gay. She had a big belly laugh. And they really disagreed on the how of what policy should be. But as a kid watching them, it was always very clear to me that they agreed. They really came together in their view of what they were after. They were both seeking empowerment for themselves, for their families, for their communities. So, you know, huge debates about how market liberties versus public sector investment, civic virtues versus experiments in living, but this just shared sense of purpose. And it was always also clear that they would just have each other's back come what may. So that was really where I learned what democracy should be, that we can have this shared purpose, this project of empowerment broadly for all of us, but then, you know, really go at it in terms of what the policy should be for getting there, but also at the same time, like, never break the bonds of love, always hold sacred the human dignity of the person in front of us.
And you've written then about this great pulling apart, where we continue to disagree about the policies and the means, but maybe are losing those core shared values. What have you seen happening?
That's right. So, I mean, it's a funny feature of those of us who are in our early 50s that our lifetimes have coincided with the rise in the country of a whole bunch of, you know, splitting up phenomena. So rise of income inequality and wealth inequality, rise of mass incarceration, also the rise of polarization, as you've named it. And so we have this incredible separating out of experience. In my own family, here I sit as a tenured faculty member at a private university, which is an incredibly privileged position to be in. At the same time, I have cousins who are dead.
You cut out there for a moment, Danielle. You're saying you had cousins?
Exactly. I'm saying I have, at the same time that here I sit in this incredibly sort of comfortable existence, I've lost cousins. So younger cousins who we've lost to substance use disorder, to homicide, for example. These are terrible and tragic things and not things I can feel at peace about. And that sort of real divergence of experience is, in some sense, you know, what the whole country has experienced. And then you throw into the middle of that misinformation and all the sort of problems of the toxicity of social media. And we start to struggle with finding solutions paths for really, really significant problems. And then we start fighting each other along the way as we get sort of stuck without solution pathways.
Before we turn to solutions, you have a couple interesting structural things you point out as problems. One, We have this system in the United States designed for a population in the 1790 census, just after the Constitution was signed, under 4 million people. Now, Wisconsin alone has almost 6 million, U.S. 330
right.
million. It's not surprising in some ways we might buckle under that strain. Why is that?
Exactly. I like to talk about our democracy as a house that we all share. It is literally designed, it is architected, it is built. The Constitution built it, but so did a whole host of other laws and the like. And the truth of the matter is that this house that we all share needs renovation. You know, it's not yet fit for purpose to deal with the sort of level of scale and complexity that we have in the 21st century. There's also the just very basic fact that this house we share wasn't originally built for everyone. So some folks got light-filled rooms and others got relegated to dark, dank basements and so forth. So I think we have a job to do to renovate our institutions, renovate our democracy so that it's fit for purpose in the 21st century, can meet our needs, and where there are really good rooms for everybody.
And then you mentioned social media a couple minutes ago, and I think, you know, people could think really easy of examples of why social media might be bad for politics. But you go back to some of the earliest writings about how our system should work, and you see the way we communicate on social media violating, in some ways, some of those early principles. Can you talk that through for us?
Well, exactly. It's an interesting fact that when the founding fathers, when the founders were designing the Constitution, they had a lot of really clear ideas about how to solve the problem of faction. They were really focused on trying to solve that. And now you could say that with our depth of polarization, like that we're in exactly the place they were trying to avoid. When they sought to solve that problem, that was really the goal of designing systems of representation, right? They were worried about the ancient examples of democracy where all the citizens gathered in the assembly and made choices together. And so instead they wanted representative democracy where we would elect people to go to Washington, or at the time go to Philadelphia, on our behalf to make those decisions. And in designing this, you know, Madison articulated the reasons for it in an essay called One of the Federalist Papers, Advocating for the Constitution, James Madison. And he said there's sort of two reasons that this principle of representation should work to address the problem of faction. One, because the representatives would be people, they would be selected to do the job of sort of filtering and synthesizing and bringing some sort of sense and sensibility to the broad range of opinions in the country. But then the other thing that was supposed to make this work was just the basic fact of the breadth of the country, the literal geographic spread, the dispersal of the people. The idea was that people with extreme views would have trouble finding each other. And that would mean they would have to go through representatives to get their views into the public sphere. And then the representatives could do that filtering and synthesizing and sort of cleaning up and moderating job. Now, obviously, that's what social media has just sort of blasted out from under us. It is no longer the case that people have to go through representatives in order to get their views into the public sphere. And we now live in a world where people with extreme views can coordinate very, very easily. So what that means is that one of the premises of the actual original design of the Constitution just no longer holds. So we can't depend on geography to be a part of our solution to the problem of faction. So in the absence of that, we actually have work to do to rethink how our very representative institutions are organized so that we can deal with the problem of faction and the problem of polarization.
Political philosopher Danielle Allen is with us from Harvard University, looking at divides in American politics and how to overcome them. We've heard about some of the problems, some of the causes she sees coming up, some possible solutions. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Some of the solutions she has on the table in her ongoing series at The Washington Post: boosting our civic engagement, making the House of Representatives bigger, finding better ways to talk, to communicate, to represent us. What do you think? What's your solution to our divisive politics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Harvard University political philosopher Danielle Allen. She says there's been a great pulling apart in American society and politics, but She says it's possible to bring Americans together again with some changes to our political system and the way we engage with it. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Danielle, one solution you've offered in your last couple of pieces, and this is something coincidentally we talked about on this show a month or two ago, making the House of Representatives bigger. How do you see that helping solve some of the crises we've been talking about?
Oh, thank you, Rob. I'm so glad to know that you've already been talking about this. That's fantastic. Yes, I think it is time for us to uncap the House of Representatives. It has been stuck at 435 for 100 years, just about, since 1929. And however, the House was always supposed to grow. And why was it supposed to grow? The point of the House of Representatives, of course, is to make the voice of the people heard in government, and representatives were supposed to be close to their constituents and to be able to be responsive to them. We're at a point now where any given rep represents about 760,000 people or so, and we will probably get close to a million by the middle of this century. So that makes it much harder for any representative to know their constituents. It makes it much harder for them to just do the work involved with constituent services. It makes it harder for voters to hold their representatives accountable. So the piece of the system that was supposed to be most about the proximity of representatives to people has gotten really, really rigid by virtue of the distance now that exists between representatives and their constituents.
Do you see that helping with the social media issue you were talking about? Because, you know, if someone's here in Wisconsin, and they, you know, they may not love their local representative, but they find somebody on the extreme of their side in Minnesota or Georgia or California or you name it. They throw money over there. They support maybe the most extreme versions of their personal politics. Does having more and closer representation help overcome that?
So I think it's a part of what we need. And the truth is, the reason I'm working on a series of columns over the whole year for the Washington Post is because I do think we need more than one thing. Mm-hmm. So I think the renovation job is big enough that, you know, you can't just fix the front door, just fix the porch. We really have to pay attention to a few different things that we need. And you've pointed to a really big issue, namely the way our elections currently work. Most elections are at this point decided in primaries, where a sliver of the activist party base is really making the decision for the electorate. So we also really need to look at how we run elections in our states to see if we can deliver a system that pulls the whole electorate in all the way through the process. So if you could do that second thing alongside a bigger Congress, then I think we start to get back to having that kind of representation that's actually responsive to the people generally.
Yeah, one of your pieces you mentioned on multiple members and ranked choice voting as options.
Exactly, yes. So, and you know, there are lots of different pieces to think about. And in some sense, it's a question of like, what do you do when at sort of which point in time? And I actually think the most important thing to do first is to think about really opening up the primary system. So to, for example, follow the examples of Louisiana, California, Arizona, and Nevada, and dispense with state-run party primaries, instead have all-comer preliminaries. And then, you know, in those all-comer preliminaries, you've got Democrats running and Republicans and maybe some Greens or some independents. Then you take on a batch of finalists. Mm. I would recommend, you know, five finalists. And then you take the general election, those five finalists, and you use instant runoff in the general so that whoever wins has to get a full majority, over 50%, before they can lift up the winner's crown. So that is a kind of mechanism that would do a lot to take the polarization out of our politics and give elected officials the right kinds of incentives. They would know that at every stage of that process, they are accountable to the whole electorate. That gives them more space to be independent in their actions and choices in Congress and keeps things focused on, you know, trying to find a big, broad majoritarian synthesis of what we want to do.
Let's bring on a caller. Ron is with us in Wautoma. Ron, hi.
Hi. I think that you should take the money out of Washington. I think that would be a big benefit, make it a volunteer position and no lobbying. I think that would help, because the people that are going to get elected are the people that are trying to get money and all the good stuff that comes along with being elected.
Ron, thanks for the call. Danielle, what do you think?
Well, it's 100% the case that we need a service ethos in our House of Representatives and across all of our elected officials. So I'm with you, was it Ron, in terms of needing a service ethos. I do think tackling campaign finance issues is an important part of getting to that. That said, I do support salaries for elected officials. We want to make sure that service is truly open to everybody and that you don't have to be in a position to pay your own salary for a full year in order to serve. So I do think it's important that elected officials be salaried.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute or so, Danielle, another point, and I think you'll be writing about this over the course of the year, boosting our civic infrastructure. Can you tease us as to what that might look like?
Oh, gosh. Thank you so much. Well, I mean, you are an example of our civic infrastructure, right? Here you are. You're covering issues locally. You're connecting local to national. But so much of the country at this point lives in news deserts where people don't have access to really basic information about what's happening in local politics. And if you look around the country, when you look at how our elections operate, often, for example, there's a requirement for public notice that things be posted in local newspapers so that the community is aware that they're happening. That whole sort of apparatus of public notice, it doesn't really function well anymore because of the decimation of local newspapers. And you can go down the line and, you know, the ways we used to have civic gathering spaces, we don't really have anymore. So we actually have to give some thought to how to rebuild those components of information sharing, space and public gathering and the like that actually support people's ability to see and shape what's happening in their own communities. So that's really what civic infrastructure is about. And I think there are a lot of folks all around the country who are trying to figure out how to get us to a place where we can reinvest in the civic infrastructure that supports healthy participation.
Danielle, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for your time.
That's Danielle Allen, professor of political philosophy, ethics, and public policy at Harvard University. She has a regular column at the Washington Post. She joined us for a look at the divides in American politics and some ways to bridge those divides. Wisconsin Supreme Court elections were once obscure, low turnout affairs. Otherwise, reliable voters often stayed home. Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz is doing everything she can to prevent that this year. And she's getting a big assist from the Democratic Party. As Sean Johnson reports, Protasiewicz has been open about her personal beliefs on issues that could come before the court.
On a Saturday night in March, people lined up down the block outside the Barrymore Theater on Madison's East Side. The featured act that night, a live recording of the national show Pod Save America, was in town to bring attention to Wisconsin's Supreme Court race. At the front of the line is Madison resident Ariel Hendrickson, who says the election boils down to two issues.
Abortion rights and making sure that gerrymandering does not get any worse in our state.
Person after person says the same thing. And Sheila Hosseini of Madison says people understand the stakes of the race, which could flip the court from a conservative to a liberal majority for the first time in 15 years.
Probably. I mean, I know people keep saying this, but this is probably one of the most important elections for Wisconsin, especially because reproductive rights are on the line.
Protasiewicz says she decided to run for the court precisely because it's so important. Prior to being a judge, she spent decades as a Milwaukee County prosecutor. Whoever wins Wisconsin's Supreme Court race will likely hear a challenge to the state's pre-Civil War abortion ban. Protasiewicz is facing former state Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly. He's backed by Republicans and endorsed by the state's three anti-abortion groups.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Judge Janet Protasiewicz.
During a brief interview in front of a packed theater at the Pod Save America recording, Protasiewicz is asked what kind of difference she could make on abortion rights if she wins.
So I'll tell you this. I have been very, very forthright that my personal value is that women have a right to choose.
She's also asked about Wisconsin's Republican-drawn legislative districts. Protasiewicz calls the maps rigged. And she adds,
I would certainly welcome the opportunity to have a fresh look at our maps.
The Democratic voters in this auditorium know her message, possibly because they've had a chance to hear it everywhere. Protasiewicz has shattered campaign fundraising records thanks to millions of dollars in transfers from the state Democratic Party. That same night, party chair Ben Wickler frames the stakes in presidential terms. He asks Democrats to imagine it's election night in 2024, The eyes of the nation are on swing state Wisconsin. A lawsuit is filed, and the court's conservative majority stops the count.
And record scratch, freeze frame, you think to yourself, in 2023, I had a chance to stop this guy from getting on the Supreme Court and casting that deciding vote.
There are those who think the level of political drama playing out in Wisconsin's Supreme Court race is inappropriate. Former Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Gieske was appointed to the court in 1993 and won election in 1994. She thinks court races have gotten too political and says both sides are to blame.
You know, historically, when we ran, and I ran a long time ago, we wouldn't go anywhere near talking about an issue that might come before the court.
Kelly has been far more guarded about sharing his personal views. He argues Protasiewicz crossed a line by sharing hers. Supreme Court races are still technically nonpartisan, but people who show up to see Protasiewicz in Madison are okay with the way she talks about the race. Carol Drysdale says it's a nice idea that a justice could be completely objective.
That someone can leave behind everything that they are and everything that they have experienced and lived through and just leave it all at the door and be completely objective. But that's not how human beings work.
Drysdale says there's more at stake in this race than just purely judicial matters. She says she knows where Protasiewicz stands on issues like abortion rights and says that's why she's voting for her. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can also read Sean Johnson's profile of former Justice Dan Kelly, the other candidate in this race, at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, what does civic engagement mean in Wisconsin? A major report tackles that question, including a series of surveys. We'll check out the findings, and you can join in with your thoughts as well. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A Wisconsin chef joins the show to share recipes and advice from a new Italian cookbook. You can let us know your favorite Italian food right now. Email ideas at WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, when we think about the future, we often think about technology, more smart devices and artificial intelligence making our lives more digital and virtual. But our next guest says that the time we spent more isolated during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic reminded us how much we value human interaction and getting to spend more time with other people face to face. He says it's an opportunity now to think carefully about what we want technology to do and not to do for us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on how we use, maybe misuse, our online technology coming out of learning at home? For some people, working at home, what did you like about that? What did you not like? Did you find yourself really yearning for more human connection? How have things changed for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. David Sachs is a journalist and freelance writer whose work appears in outlets like the New York Times, Bloomberg, and the New Yorker. He's the author of 5 books. His latest is called The Future is Analog, How to Build a More Human World. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's go back to before COVID. You write about this notion, sort of a techno-utopian idea that we're going to get more digital stuff, more virtual stuff. We should use as much of it as we can, and it's going to make our lives better. I'm oversimplifying, maybe. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think this is something that goes back decades, if not even before, right? It's this human cycle of invention, which is a very, I think, a particularly American thing, that there is a new technology that's coming out, and this is going to make such sweeping changes to our lives that it's going to completely reorganize the way we live in the most wonderful colored way. Or the flip side of it's the kind of dystopian Terminator version of that. And for decades, this was kind of the defining way we spoke about the future. But in the past couple of decades, and especially really the past 10, 15, 20 years with the sort of advent of the internet and smartphones and all the things that have come with it, it's really kind of captivated every level of our discourse around the future. And to the point where, you know, the term "the future is digital" was just kind of this accepted gospel of the way we were going to live and sort of our predestined path forward.
And here came COVID. And the heart of your book is looking at this as this accidental experiment where we tried this digital future on for size. You break it down to a lot of different realms in our lives. Big picture, though, what did we learn?
Well, I think all of us around the world, except for some people in New Zealand for a few months when they kind of skated away before it hit them, we every one of us was kind of forced to live or interact in the key parts of our life through digital technology almost exclusively for weeks or months or even years at a time, depending on where you live. I mean, if you're in China, you're just coming out of this right now. And so while before the sort of notion of the digital future was this far off, you know, fantastical kind of utopian thing, all of a sudden it's April 2020 and we're all living through this. We are all working online unless our job required our bodies to be there, whether you're sort of an ambulance driver or a doctor or a construction worker or, you know, cooking in a restaurant as an essential worker. Every child from kindergarten through to, you know, graduate school of university did their schooling online for, again, weeks or months or years. And everything. I mean, you know, the way you would interact with family, you would have a reunion with your friends, you would shop or you know, have a restaurant meal. All of it was done through screens, through technology, through the internet, right? That digital future of like, in the future, you're going to live at home. You're not going to have to wear hard, difficult pants. Everything you're going to do is going to be on your screen. It's going to be this wonderful thing. You're going to exercise. You're going to pray. You want to see a concert. That concert is going to be beamed right to your fingers. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, right. This is it. This is what I'm living. And I think for most people, that got old pretty quick. We saw the limitations of that. We saw where that was insufficient and where the analog, by which I mean the non-digital spaces, relationships, and interactions of our life actually seemed more valuable. We came to realize that. And that's really what this book is about, what we learned from that experience and where we saw those limitations.
Talking to David Sachs about his new book. It's called The Future is Analog, How to Build a More Human World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you'd like to share your experience, maybe early in COVID days, doing a lot of things online that you might have done in person, were there things you thought worked better? What did you miss? Did it reaffirm the value for you of seeing people in person, doing things, going to work in person, if you're one of the people who worked at home? Love to hear your experience, your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, let's go to work now. This is one of the chapters in your book where many people, not all, but many people were working online and discovered, you write, that we're missing something. What were we missing?
Well, I think it was all the things that are generally not thought of as quote unquote work, right? We think of work, and we were talking about sort of knowledge-based work. In short, work you can do on a computer in an office or at home, basically. And so we think of work as like, I must do these tasks on these programs in order to get paid my salary or my money or to achieve the things I need to achieve. And all the other stuff, the commuting time, whether you're driving or taking the public transit into work or walking, the coffee on the way there, the little meetings you might have that take some time in a room, or the short conversations at the water cooler or the coffee machine or on your way to lunch, all those are just kind of these extraneous things. The office, the sad potted plants, the neon lights, or wherever it is. Maybe you work in some cool place that's like a loft in Milwaukee or whatever. These are just kind of like the external trappings. We just got rid of that and got right down to the work, the sort of the meat of it, right? The economic activity. But actually all those other things are the things that people miss. And it's funny. It's a lot of what people said is it was the things that they often complained about. Oh, another, you know, oh, Rob, another birthday. Like, come on. Do we really need, you know, another sad cake in the lunchroom? Oh, Rob's, you know, making another joke again in a meeting. Oh,
oh no,
okay.
People never miss that.
Yeah, no, no. You know, oh, someone's writing something on a whiteboard. And actually what people realize is the things that they missed about work was not the specific task they could do. That they could do, you know, you could work on an Excel spreadsheet at home. You could work on an Excel spreadsheet in a park. You can work on an Excel spreadsheet in an office. It was all these other things that added up to something bigger. It was these physical touch points, the different information that you pick up when you're walking through a space. There was someone I spoke to, his name's Andres Hofbrauer, and he's an occupational researcher and in New York. And he studied, you know, the offices of architects, and he defined it as what was missing was this thing called embodied cognition, which is this larger understanding you get about ideas when you're in a shared space working with other people. And sometimes it's passing by someone's desk and seeing something pinned up or seeing something there. It's the snippets of conversation you have. All those things are the things that people actually realized had value, but only once they were sort of taken away and they were forced to just subsist on the tasks at hand.
Your solution here, you say we're having debates about should people who can work at home or work in the office or what percentage or whatever. You say that's not really the right question. And some of this applies to the non-work things too. You're hoping that we take this experience and just rethink, like, how do we work? Why do we work this way? What questions do you hope we start asking?
Well, I think the first is you know, what is the actual value of the spaces we have or the work we're doing, right? Or those relationships, and really assess them in a very critical way, because we can do many jobs remotely and we can do many things without having to commit to leasing a giant office space, and so on and so forth. But, you know, we're still stuck inside this 19th century industrial revolution model of, you know, you will go to this place and we will have your body in this place for this many hours. And for each of these hours, you will pay this many dollars. And that is productivity. And the reality is many people can work, you know, and do the same task in less time, in a greater amount of time. And most people, I think, just want to be treated as adults and given some sort of autonomy, which is a really difficult thing for large organizations, for bosses, for managers, for owners to sort of relinquish. But unless we have those conversations about what does it actually mean to allow people to work in the way that works for them, we'll never get beyond the sort of simple idea of, like, is the office the future? Is working from home the future? Is it 3 days a week and Mondays, Rob, you're coming in, and Tyler, you're coming in, and Susan, you're coming in, but then the other team's coming in on Wednesdays? How are we going to coordinate that? Okay, we're going to have an all hands on Thursdays, so come with your best ideas on Thursdays. It's this sort of false narrative and this sort of dead end street that most businesses are trying to deal with now. And I think we need to move beyond that and say, what are the parts of work? What are the parts of this that we actually realize have a value by doing in person together in one space? What are the parts of it that it doesn't really matter where or when or how someone does it, as long as that work gets done? And how can we find a mixture that gives people that balance, that gives us the best of both worlds? Because I think the idea before is maximum efficiency is going to equal maximum productivity. And so if we can have everybody working either, you know, under my thumb while I watch them at the office, like some bad boss from a 1950s movie, or any movie really, or the opposite of everybody go home, everything's remote, and this is the most efficient way to do it, and then people are unhappy or disconnected in that way, what's the best mix? And that's going to be different for every organization, every group in an organization, every individual who's working. There's no one easy answer. It requires that experimentation. But this is what people are going to be figuring out for the next, I don't know, how many years or decades.
We're talking to writer David Sacks. His new book is The Future is Analog: How to Build a More Human World. You could join in at 800-642-1234. In person versus online, what works for you? What doesn't? What do you prefer when it comes to work, learning, having fun, hanging out with people, seeing a show? call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to David Sachs, author of the new book, The Future is Analog, How to Build a More Human World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you worked or learned or taught or had fun, recreated online a lot with the start of the pandemic, were there good things about it? What did you miss about interacting with people in person? Was it a big relief when you could do that again? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, good afternoon. I am a teacher, and we did find out the hard way. Teaching is very much a human interactive person-to-person kind of activity, which is going to explain an awful lot of why we're seeing the educational COVID deficit in our kids today.
Kevin, thanks for the call. David, you're a parent. You've got a chapter about this.
Kevin, first of all, thank you for everything you do. I can't imagine how difficult it was for you as a teacher during those years. Certainly, I observed it with my own children who were in elementary school. I think this is you know, one of the areas where it was crystal clear where the future lies, and it doesn't lie in remote streaming video education. There's been billions of dollars poured into it. The best universities, the best minds worked on creating this future of school being remote and virtual. And I think what we saw is that it was a dismal failure all over the world, whether it was wealthy countries, wealthy schools, middle income. It didn't really matter. It didn't matter if it was public schools or private schools. It didn't matter if it was kindergarten universities. It really was a failure, and the data has come in to show that on learning loss, on engagement, on emotional engagement, on the mental health of children of different ages. And the key lesson is there is a difference between information delivery and teaching and education and knowledge. Information delivery is what technology, whether it's radio or television or the internet, does really well. If I want to find out a particular fact about something or learn about a particular thing, I can find that information out very easily. It is at the tip of my fingers. I can type it in and watch videos and see all sorts of things about it. But education is built on relationships, human relationships, the relationships between a teacher like Kevin and their students, the relationships between the students and their peers and each other, and the relationship between the school and that community that it's in. And I think if any of us think back to the best teachers we had or experiences at school, whether it's, you know, kindergarten or if you went to, you know, University of Madison, Wisconsin, that experience is all about those human relationships. I don't remember very much of the particular facts or figures or things that I learned in school. I remember my teachers. I remember the peers. I remember that learning. And those relationships are actually what allow us to take the information that we're being taught and turn it into a deeper knowledge about being a human in the world. And I think we saw just how insufficient digital technology is in doing that. You need people to sort of facilitate that relationship, teachers like Kevin.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. We're talking to David Sachs. His new book is called The Future is Analog, How to Build a More Human World. Back to your calls. Barbara is with us in Fort Atkinson. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say, I think we have a generation gap, at least in the working world. I am 73 years old, and I work full-time. Love my job, love the people I work with. And when I was home for 15 months during COVID, I was just so lonely and missing the people that I work with. And I ended up working like 16 hours a day because I could not separate my work time from my home time. But the people, the younger people, I would say maybe 30 and younger, they love working from home. And when we try to hire people, that's the first thing out of their mouth. Well, can I work remotely? So,
Barbara, thanks for sharing that. You're not alone, I think, in your experiences there. David, what do you think?
First of all, I'm qualified to speak on this subject because I'm someone who's worked from home for himself his entire career for the past 20 odd years. So I'm no expert in workplace anything. And that's my sort of caveat. I think what's interesting is there is this what I call generational generalization that people make. And I sort of hear it in Barbara's comment, which is that, well, the younger people, and it's usually anyone, you know, in their 30s or younger, right? The dreaded millennials, the Gen Zs, the Gen Alphas, I guess, that are coming up next to them. The assumption is that because they are a generation that has grown up with digital technology, this is kind of what they want. This is their desire. But the facts don't really bear this out. If that was the case, then all those children who were learning online would have thrived. And actually, they were the ones who really hated it the most. And you're seeing that in many workplaces. It's actually the younger people who want to go in for mentorship, to build relationships, to learn, because they live in a house with a bunch of roommates and they don't have the space to work. And conversely, I've heard from many people of Barbara's generation, the baby boomer generation, they love working from home. It's the greatest thing. They don't have to drive. It's more convenient and so forth. So it really is down to people's individual circumstances. And I would caution against making generalizations based around people's age or demographics or other sort of large things. You know, when you ask people, why do you prefer to work from home, or why do you prefer, you know, using digital technology rather than an analog alternative in this sort of way, it comes up in their answers. And that answer often has very little to do with their age or particular demographics. It's individual preferences, it's circumstances, it's, you know, I have a cat and I have to stay home with the cat, or I have young children, or I live really far from somewhere, or so forth.
Barbara, thanks for that call. Just a couple minutes, David, left. There's another solution here. The reaction that, though, the problem here is that our digital world wasn't good enough yet, and so we have projects like Meta, formerly Facebook, saying we'll have virtual reality so we can look like we're sitting in a classroom with our classmates and the teacher, or David, Rob, we can sit at a virtual coffee shop and talk. That is what's going to make this all work. You have thoughts about that?
Thoughts indeed, if not comments. The first one is, you know, if you're Mark Zuckerberg and you look at what's happening and you see how so many of these things failed and people were clambering to get out back into the real world, and your solution is, aha, I know what the solution is. The screens were not close enough to our eyes, and we actually just have to physically strap them on. And then, you know, you can be an eel and I can be an octopus, and we can be having this conversation, Rob, in sort of Wisconsin Public Radio virtual reality. It's almost a stunning lack of imagination to sort of see things that way. And the proof is in the pudding, right? Meta's stock is, you know, down tremendously. And that's because no one is opting to do this. This has been out for a year. You know, no one's buying these headsets. I think at some point it's like on average a day, there's, I don't know, 200,000 people on this Meta thing using it. How many people listen to this show on average? Just asking.
Well, fewer than that, I'll admit.
But that's
just Wisconsin.
You know, let's say a Wisconsin Public Radio aggregate listenership is probably greater than the number of people worldwide using this virtual reality future, which bodes well for the future of public radio, I think, but doesn't bode so well for the future of this purported virtual solution. And why is that? Because we're still human beings. We still get our greatest meaning and connection and joy from the real analog world. We want to touch things. We want to smell things. We want to see people. This is the freedom that we were clambering for during those years and months of lockdown. And I think that's the hard lesson that we have to take with us, right? We tested this out. We kicked the tires. We took it for a test drive. Parts of it worked, but that as an entirety of a vision of a future is not one that most people want to go forward with.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's David Sacks. His new book is called The Future is Analog: How to Build a More Human World. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.